for water, PFAS has been in the news quite a lot recently, right? There's 3M, the materials company that's well known for their sticky tapes. They've been basically fined several billion dollars. It was of a fine for basically putting out PFAS into the world, which other companies also do, but they were just the first ones to be fined.
Welcome back to the Clean Techies podcast, where we interview the top climate tech founders and investors to share their stories, advice, and lessons when it comes to building and investing in climate. Today, we are joined by Tobias Egle, a VC at M Ventures, the CVC arm of Merck, a large pharmaceuticals company. We wanted to speak with Tobias because of his work investing in deep tech material science innovations. In today's call, we cover decarbonization of the electronics manufacturing space, a very hot topic recently is PFAS. We talked about that. Advice to technical founders on how to hire talent and how to scale at the right times. The impact of AI on climate tech, designing for manufacturability. And we closed off with advice on getting into VC, especially from a more technical perspective. Really great conversation overall with Tobias. We hope you enjoy it. And here is Tobias. All right. Welcome to the show, Tobias. How are you doing today?
Doing awesome. How are you doing?
I cannot complain. Just well, this will come out in the new year, but you know, right now we're recording leading up to the holidays, and going to be going back to Wisconsin soon. So just kind of trying to wrap things up for the year, and excited for a long break to decompress from this year. But yeah, super excited to have this conversation. I guess, you know, for everybody listening, can you start us out with giving us kind of a quick introduction to who you are and maybe a little bit of the story on how you ended up here?
Yeah. Happy to do that. The quickest version of who I am is basically I'm a material scientist who transitioned into the world of venture capital. And there I'm really sticking to my previous passions since I'm still pursuing topics that are close to my heart and brain, so to say. So it's like basically materials and sustainability. This is sort of how I define myself. And right now I do this with the German Merck's venture fund. And when I say Merck, it's the multinational science and technology company headquartered in Darmstadt in Germany. So Merck KGaA is the sort of the parent name, but I'm over here in Boston, as you know, not too far from you in New York. Yeah, how did I actually get there? So basically, during my PhD, let's maybe start there. In the last year, I was in somewhat of a crisis, which is not so uncommon. I would say it's very pervasive in academia, especially as a PhD student, to be in a crisis multiple times during this journey, and especially at the last years, because like, okay, what am I going to do? I think the pandemic, though, additionally had really instilled this deep sense of, I want to do something with like impact, purpose, and the topics I care about in my life. So there's been like a whole, this has actually impacted me quite a lot. And I had a lot of time to think during the pandemic too, which helped with my decision. So I you might not even know this, but like I've actually started a company with a friend that was sort of pre-seed, if you can even say that, basically tinkering with a cool idea and talking to people in the ecosystem and so on. And this had really helped me to explore the entrepreneurial space, but I realized that basically my idea wasn't really as viable to pursue this directly after graduation. So I explored other things to do that would keep me there in the meantime. And during having coffee chats here and there, basically this is what brought me to Inventure, to this role in VC, quite serendipitously in the end, where right after finishing, I almost did, right, I didn't even know what VC was. But then I sort of bumped into this serendipitously and was like, hey, this could be really awesome.
Very good. I like that. So I guess one thing I don't think I've ever asked anybody this before, but you mentioned it's not uncommon for people finishing their PhDs to kind of be like in this kind of sort of a crisis. Mm. You know, why can you talk a little bit more about that and specifically how you find yourself or other people typically break it to get in kind of transitioning from this kind of academic space to more of like, hey, let's get into work space.
Yeah. I think Well, like the what you learn in grad school is it's very niche, right? Focused on a particular topic. It's also focused on a little bit of a specific skill set that's more like research and writing, in writing academically, right? This is, I think I have learned so much in the meantime, what like how writing is like can be so different, right? I would write completely differently now, because the ideal audience is very different. In the academic world, you typically there's just only like one audience, right? Like your peer group that you write for. There's not really too much variation unless you're maybe writing a grant with your professor. The crisis is really because also if you don't intern during those 5 years or so during your PhD, you're just always in the same world, which is not a bad thing, right? If you're going to be a professor, that's kind of what you need to do. But there's maybe, let's say, around 80% or so, that's probably not the right number, but around there, who just don't follow this path, right? They go into industry or pursue maybe research in industry or start a business, let's say, right? It's kind of tricky. Like, there's not that much preparing you for it unless, let's say, you specifically seek it out, join some clubs on campus, or really get involved like into the weeds of it. There are a lot of opportunities, but you just need to really go out of your way to find them. I think that's just sort of this crisis a little bit. You really need to think of like, what do I want to do with myself? If it's not sort of, I mean, like consulting is sort of like a very standard path, let's say, that many people go into, because it's sort of the path where you can go wrong in a way. But there's also people who are like, hey, maybe this is not the right fit for me. Like, what else is there? And this what else is just a tricky question, I think. So that's where the crisis come from. And yeah, you just need a lot of intrinsic motivation to kind of reach out to people and talk to them, I think, to overcome.
Shout out to our sponsors, Net Zero Insights. Net Zero Insights' mission is to enable the transition to a sustainable future by giving decision makers access to the leading market intelligence platform on climate innovation. Through the Net Zero platform, Net Zero Insights provides high-quality data and insights on the climate tech venture market by being the best at tracking organizations and funding rounds. I personally have had a great time using this to prepare for the podcast and researching companies, funding rounds, VCs, and the latest I need to know about the climate tech ecosystem. Use the link in our description to schedule your personalized demo with the team and claim your 10% discount. Thanks again to the Net Zero Insights team for sponsoring this show.
Now, I think that's interesting is, generally, and this can be applied to other things besides just getting your PhD, is that if people are in a certain kind of track, it's very easy to just stay on the track kind of like without thinking about it, right? If you want to reference the Matrix, right? People just kind of doing the thing that most people around them are doing and following it. But if you really want to, whether it's your career or even in the terms of building climate technologies, for example, kind of find other inputs to get you thinking in a different way than the people around you so you can pair two things. I think many large innovators and very successful people kind of intersect two different things that are not usually considered to go together. So I think that's pretty interesting. Can you tell us a little bit more about the actual, you said you bumped into venture capital. Can you tell us the a little bit about the story of getting into M Ventures? What was it like? How did you meet them, and what made you ultimately decide that this was the right thing to do?
I bumped into one of the at the time principals of the firm through a friend, actually through two different friends. So there were two sort of different ways how I found out about them. Well, they were local. Or at least had to have an office here in Boston, very close to where I was in Cambridge. So that kind of that's always a plus. I think if you're already in the locale, then these kind of Brownian motion, serendipitous meetups or introductions can happen, right? You have like a bit similar friend circles overlaps. How I found out about VC was when I really wanted to sort of go into entrepreneurial mode a little bit and just learn a little bit of the what are like sort of the ground like some fundamentals of how would you even think about it, like what kind of like IP would you need, how does this work. And there was I don't want to like tout any specific like program or so, but I think there was sort of this early stage entrepreneurial program from the Engine here in Cambridge that I participated in together with my co-founder that very directly exposed me to VC, just because like VCs were managing the program, mm-hmm. and we had sessions with them. And then also NSF has like these customer discovery programs, NSF iCore, they have local chapters, and just meeting other folks who wanted to do similar things, you just kind of get to talk to each other. And then from there on, this was kind of like a moving, it was almost like a, how do you say, it's like a snowball effect. Yeah, mm. That's what I mean. It's just sort of builds on the momentum. And then I started listening to podcasts. Like at the time, I was super into MCJ podcasts and just like learning more about climate through this angle. And then you go to like a few events and then you see really sort of some momentum building. But it all started like very mm-hmm. small, like, hey, I want to just kind of learn more about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I guess why don't we get into, you know, talking about M Venture specifically. So obviously they hired a materials science person, right? They're a corporate venture arm. Can you talk about what M Ventures focuses on maybe in relation to the corporate, just a kind of what do you focus on? What are you looking to invest into?
The way how we interact, or like the difference between us, is really that we're sort of a small team, like a small venturing team under this bigger corporate umbrella. Most of our work, like other VCs, is externally facing, right? But we do have some of those internal conversations, like stakeholder discussions with experts or like executive leadership, mainly to align strategy and to see like, hey, where do they want to go? Where do we want to go? Where's sort of like a good middle path, and where could we kind of add some foresight basically into the roadmap of the company? That's kind of one of the main purposes, right? When we speak of what's our strategic value add to Merck, or why does this make sense, is really to bring in ideas from like the external innovation ecosystem, because just like large corporates, there's like this term innovator's dilemma, right? Where you're just too entrenched in a certain vertical, almost like our PhD example before, you're so mm-hmm. specialized. It's tricky to see the next step perhaps. And that's kind of, that's where we come in on sort of a high level. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the nature of the interaction. And then of course the partners of the fund, they basically manage the relationship to make sure we are actually keeping the LP also happy, right? That we do what's sort of beneficial for all of us. What do we look at? So we basically follow the business verticals of Merck. But by the way, in the US, we are EMD Serono, Millipore Sigma, and EMD Electronics. And it makes kind of sense to mention at this point, because these are like also the verticals. And so Serono is basically the life science business, the healthcare business. And for us, healthcare, we have a healthcare fund, is basically therapeutics oriented. So there are a few strategic indications like oncology, immunology, neurology, and fertility. And there's quite a lot of flexibility if we do like preclinical or clinical stuff. But I'll not go into too much detail there. And the second one, which is Millipore Sigma, is the life science business, which is relatively broad, basically any tools or technologies that aid life science research or biomanufacturing. So biomanufacturing or life science research. Some interesting stuff there is, I'm hearing this in the news like lately quite frequently, like now, like gene therapy, right, is like, is really sort of en vogue, and like it's sort of there's some momentum building there. So manufacturing of like gene therapy manufacturing is super expensive and a very time consuming process. So this is, for instance, something that my life science colleagues really focus on, right? Looking for startups addressing those problems, or bioprocessing solutions, even like AI discovery for antibodies, those things. The third one for EMD Electronics is the semiconductor business. So Merck sells semiconductor materials to fabs like Intel, TSMC, Samsung, and so on. And this is sort of where I put more than 50% of my focus into. So semiconductor is sort of a lot of my jam these days. So the way how we think about it there is we don't want to invest in too many things that are really like directly competitive. So like we wouldn't really like invest in a just only materials company in the space. But we basically want to see where is the industry going. So it could be functional components, it could be chip design, it could be data center infrastructure, a very kind of current topic that that I've been very involved with. How can you make optical links in data centers basically faster, less latency, mm-hmm. So these kind of things. And also secure data collaboration, because that's something that's super key for in our, like, we work with a lot of data, right, in those industries, in healthcare, in semiconductor, but how to securely exchange those, that's kind of a whole different question. Mm-hmm. The last one, which is kind of, and then I'm going to shut up about this topic, but it's like the last one is sort of a bit more of a umbrella thing. It's we call it our Frontier Tech and Sustainability Fund, which goes sort of by saying this is how we define sustainability for us in all of those other three sectors, so healthcare, life science, and electronics, right? What can we invest in that sort of contributes to more sustainabilities in those areas?
Hey guys, sorry for the interruption. I just need a few seconds because Soma and I have two quick favors to ask. Putting out the show each week takes about 15 to 20 hours between us, so it's a lot of effort. And it would mean the world to us if you would leave a review and mention your favorite episode. Secondly, if you're not already, go over and subscribe to the podcast on Substack. The content is free, but if you like hanging out with us each week, maybe we're even the kind of guys you'd like to buy a coffee for on occasion, consider becoming a paid subscriber. For the cost of one lavender latte a month, you can help us immensely. Thank you for tuning in consistently and helping us to share our guests' stories. Now back to the show. So on that topic then, this is perfect. You know, I want to understand what across, let's probably focus on the kind of the electronics business and then perhaps the life sciences space more. You know, what are the main ways that you can decarbonize this, right? So people may not be familiar, like when they say, okay, we need to decarbonize these businesses, what are the main, carbon intensive aspects that need to be worked on? And are you investing in hardware to solve that? Is it more software to identify ways to make it better? You know, just kind of walk us through that.
Let's do with with semis. That's sort of what I can comment on the best. So we focus on hardware, but not exclusively. So maybe an interesting example to share, which is, well, maybe not strictly sustainability, but we have recently invested in actually a pure software company called Tignis out of Seattle. They are using reinforcement learning to flatten the wafer after it's processed and before it goes into the patterning step, the lithography step, which is sort of what the expensive ASML tools do. And since these nodes for the smallest transistors are so small, if you have warpages in the wafer, your projection of the light will miss the spot and you'll get failures and sort of low yield. So what they do, which is kind of funny that, other, like these huge semiconductor corporates actually haven't been able to do, is really to make a product that sits on top of those manufacturing machines to calculate a pattern to solve for the stress and flatten this wafer, basically make it like flat within like less than sort of 10 micrometer height distance. So make it incredibly flat after you have like these stresses in the wafer, and then they're actually contributing to lots and lots of value in the end, because it directly impacts like the excess that you would not have anymore. So you have basically less scrap, less waste material. It sounds very niche, but it's actually, I think it's a really cool example of AI machine learning in sort of semiconductor and how that can really like solve some gnarly problems in the manufacturing value chain, especially, and it gets worse and worse with smaller nodes. This problem is like getting more pervasive and the pain is getting bigger. But maybe lifting it sort of up, like the general, right? What can generally be done sort of in this ecosystem? So you can divide it sort of in a bunch of different topics. The water is a big topic because there's a lot of water being consumed in fabs. I can comment on those a bit more, but let me, there's like a few categories that sort of the broader ones. So there's water, there's more materials, there's energy and emissions. So I would sort of bucket into those four. Just to mention one example for each, perhaps. So for water, PFAS has been in the news quite a lot recently, right? There's 3M, the materials company that's well known for their sticky tapes. They've been basically fined several billion dollars. It was of a fine for basically putting out PFAS mm-hmm. into the world, which other companies also do, but they were just the first ones to be fined. As a result of this, they actually they sold. They just, you know, got rid of their whole business unit.
That's a good solution. Can you talk a little bit about that, because there's a lot of people who don't really understand what PFAS is, and it'd be good to just kind of get a summary of what exactly this is.
Yeah. So PFAS basically are substances with a lot of fluor in it, are molecules with a lot of fluor in it. Mostly it's like a carbon and a fluor, because it's sort of alkyl chains. So basically longer C carbon chains, and then there's like some hydrogen, and then there's a lot of carbon. This fluor has like the function of, for instance, like in your pan being like very anti-stick. It's sort of right. It's easy to clean. It's like great to cook like a sunny side up egg in, and so on. In the like semiconductor process, for instance, the photoresist, basically the thing that you cure in the lithography step to create a pattern on your wafer, this also contains PFAS. There are cleans when you clean your chamber. Basically, to make sure there's no contaminants in there, you sort of clean it and then you purge it again. Those cleans often are NF3. So there's like one nitrogen and three fluor atoms in this gas. So there's like a lot of fluor around. There's also sulfur hexafluoride, for example, is another one. So there are a lot of chemicals or chemicals overall just involved in the semiconductor manufacturing process that just contain fluor. And the reason is because they just work so well. They just get the job done. And I mean, the semiconductor industry, right, is very conservative, and it's an extremely competitive business where really like you look at, you have like very clear KPIs, right? Things need to be in spec, and they need to work, and they need to work like every single time, because if there's a screw up in the system, the fab has to be down for like hours, a few days. It's immediately tens or hundreds of millions of dollars lost. So those materials are incredibly hard to get rid of because they just work so well. And if you introduce another material until it qualifies, it's just a long cycle. Mm-hmm. But this is a problem that I hope, right, step by step, slowly gets solved.
So is it currently that there's really, I mean, is there a way to destroy these? Because that's what my understanding is. These are something that you can't really destroy, but are there existing technologies, or does there have to be a lot of innovation there?
So yeah, you can do different things. So what's done now, if you remove it, is you just incinerate and basically break it down into something that's less harmful or that's just, not as forever, right? PFAS are known as the forever chemicals just because they stick around. They're really hard to remove from like your body or anything. So just burning them and really like basically breaking the bonds by force is the solution that people have now. It's easy, but it's also very energy intensive, right? Mm-hmm. You need to basically have all like the energy to break chemical bonds. That's like it's huge energy.
Yeah. You can't just throw them on a campfire, probably.
But okay. There are basically, I mean, what we're actively looking at is there are startups that use many different ways to try to destroyed in a different way, from more physical, chemical, or biological ways. So there's even companies that are engineering enzymes to break those, basically to break down these molecules, which is a really hard task to do because nature hasn't been trained to do this, right? So they don't exist. So you have to sort of engineer those enzymes and to arrive at something that's so powerful, or basically to lower the barrier for those enzymes to crack those up is quite hard.
So is this one of those situations where, because of some of the recent news with 3M, the manufacturing companies are all like quite worried that they're going to also get hit with fines? So they're I assume the manufacturing facilities themselves, people who are making these or creating these, are looking for, very actively looking for, either alternatives or ways to get rid of them, because it'll go from being something they didn't think about before to now being a large cost center, so they need to destroy them?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. Basically, yeah, there was a bit of a wake-up call, but most companies are aware of this and have been already sort of efforts underway. However, this just kind of intensified really like the progress. There's an industry association called SIA, S-I-A, the Semiconductor, I think it's literally called the Semiconductor Industry Association. And they have, for instance, they have a whole working group just around PFAS and different kinds of PFAS. And they released a really extensive report, really detailing how much PFAS is it actually, in which process, and what could be different avenues to destruct, but also what does policy do, right? Where does the government move to in drinking water or in sort of effluent from the semiconductor fab, and what can be done? There's a lot of quantification on that end, which is really good. And actually from our CTO office, one of the fellows, he was leading this effort in a major way. I don't know to what extent, to be honest, but I remember he sent this report along like a few months ago. So there's basically corporates being actively involved in those bodies, right, to try to solve these problems. And but the nature of the game, I think, is replacing it in the short term is like not possible. That's like the long term effort, and in the short term, it's like just removal, just move it out of the cycle. Just find ways to collect and remove PFAS.
And so would you say, you know, obviously it may be slightly different for M Ventures, but for the majority of venture firms, these businesses have to have a large market. So when it comes to, hey, you know, destruction is a short-term solution, at some point, you know, somebody's going to innovate and create an alternative that has a very high potential market size. But when you look at something like this, where it's like, hey, we just need to take care of this in the meantime, yes, it'll go on for a while before we figure this out. Is that a large enough market to invest in from a venture perspective? Or is it more of like, hey, this is just something that is going to cost so much that for now we have to do it, but maybe the total, you know, lifetime value of these companies won't be that high?
Yeah, that's a tricky one. But I would say the value also for human and planetary health, the value to remove it or not further accumulate in the ecosystem is huge in the long term, right? But it's hard to really make this a VC investable market, right? Because this is something where there's also uncertainty, like a lot of uncertainty and risk that's really just because of, it's like uncertain where the thresholds that policy will sort of dictate where those thresholds will be. And depending on where the thresholds are going to be, and the EPA has set pretty low thresholds for now. But there's just a lot of things that are like not really certain yet. And I don't think it's not a really classic like a financial VC game, but it is sort of a big topic for folks in industries where this is concerned. Like Intel Capital is looking at this too. We're looking at this, a bunch of the other semiconductor, mostly corporate venture funds do, where Heritage Group is another. They do, they look at this a lot as well, for instance. But only, I feel like really only when this is when you have a skin in the game in some way, then yeah. this sort of becomes something for you to invest in. Yeah.
I mean, because obviously it's important to save fines, right? You don't want to get huge penalties, but the upside may not necessarily be there. Or when I just think about it, because I've heard other people talk about investing in this space recently, some mm-hmm. VCs, and I was thinking like, okay, well, I don't know that that's going to work very well, but obviously there's a need. So maybe invest in it, but just consider it at a different scale, right? You may have to just invest fewer dollars overall if you're going to get the outcome you want, right?
Yeah.
I think that's an interesting point.
Yeah. And maybe sort of one quick addition, like, I guess if you're focusing on it from the communal wastewater, or like, right, from the city or like the state point of view, what they need to do to ensure like clean drinking water for all of us, that is maybe a more investable for the general
collection or something.
Yeah. Or like, I know that like Mass Ventures invested in Aclarity, one of the Massachusetts based PFAS companies, and some water specialists like I think Burnt Island Ventures, for instance, they have also invested in a lot of water companies, including PFAS. So there are definitely a lot of different angles on this, and they're all, I've learned, a bit different, because you're looking for different molecules, different chain lengths, different concentrations, and that just requires sort of a different view on what the technology should be.
Yeah, I could definitely foresee there being a kind of identification / collection play, because that's not something that you can, even if you change the alternative in 5 years, right, you still have a lot of downstream effects from what's already there. So that's quite interesting. One question kind of on a macro level, you know, when you look at, or when you talk to these deep tech founders today, what do you notice seems to be the biggest gap? And if you have any kind of feel for where they're headed, where, you know, what's the next thing in this space of deep tech founders, and maybe where they're coming from, but currently, where's the biggest gap that you normally see?
You mean in terms of
the founders? Generally speaking, like, what, you know, everybody has a certain set of skills. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes when you look at kind of the history of venture, you see kind of people, founders will evolve to an extent, right? You know, in software for now, you know, building a software venture is relatively straightforward because people understand the means to get there. But some things have to evolve. So when it comes to deep tech, are there any big gaps that you typically see where you're like, wow, these guys got great technology, but they're just not thinking about the business model or that, things like that?
Okay, got it. Yeah, the one thing that really comes to mind, because we're like early stage, right? And that means a lot of our portfolio founders are actually sort of post-academic founders, right? It feels like it could almost be me. So it's also like a fun aspect working with those people. But there is a high appreciation for the technology, right? But there is a certain point where you really need to be focused on business development and really on productization of it. And I just think that this is not like at the very beginning, right? But just like not missing the time and actually hiring adequately for this transition, right? You need to have a lot of foresight to do this, and sort of being at the right stage and really hiring, just hiring with this foresight so that you're really ready to propel forward. I think this is sort of one of the biggest gaps as you have basically academic founders, right? Mm-hmm. Sometimes a great advisory board or just like folks who hopefully giving you a valuable and good advice that can help. But I had recently seen sort of basically like a, let's just say, not mentioning names, right? But like a team that is thinking about, okay, we how do we get to the Series A basically, right? And then when you ask like, oh, so who's doing product, right? Then there were like no show of hands. So I was like, oh, okay, like that needs to change. So I think these kind of things are very challenging to sort of transition from the where you're doing like R&D, but like more D, right? More development than actually research at the seed stage, developing from this D phase into this building a product phase. Mm-hmm. And then that's really hard in deep tech, I think.
Hey guys, we need your help with something. In order to better understand what you like most about the show, what you dislike, and how we can help you, please take 7 minutes to fill out our listener survey if you haven't already. It only takes about 7 minutes, but it will drastically improve our ability to give you the best content that you're looking for. Thanks for your help. Now back to the show.
I think it's quite fascinating because this is something I've bumped into from my day work in recruitment, is that a lot of very brilliant, you know, very sharp people coming out of university building these companies. And in some cases they have boards. In a lot of cases they don't, because I interact with a lot of early companies. They also, because they don't have experience building companies, they don't have, let's say, you know, a hiring thesis, or they don't have any of these ideas flushed out on how to work with the broader business as a whole, right? How to build a business. And I just find it something, I think Eli Gashayat mentioned this extensively when he was talking about the need for picking a really good board of advisors, because you need people to tell you what you don't know. When you're junior, you may know the science really well, but that's exactly the thing. You're a PhD, you have a very particular niche you focused on. And beyond that, you just don't have certain experiences that somebody who's, you know, say 50 or something and built a couple companies will have. So I think it's really interesting to see the, maybe you have take on this, but one of my kind of, I guess you could say, fears recently has been that there'll be all of these high talent people and a lot of VCs investing in them. There's obviously some very good VCs, but there's also a lot of VCs that just kind of in for the ride of climate, that I wonder if some of these, if too many of these hardware companies are just going to flop and it's going to be clean tech 1.0 on repeat. So do you have any comments on this and how you see people kind of hedging to make sure that we don't have all this capital just get evaporated and burnt into the air?
So yeah, I think that in climate, maybe more than ever now, sort of PR is what gets a lot of people excited. There's a bit of a game to, I mean, let's say like, oh, getting highlighted in Canary Media or like in some of those outlets that are sort of very right specific that also lots of investors read or so. It's almost like back in the day when like all tech companies wanted to be in TechCrunch. So that kind of bit like hype cycle of just following what sort of the media suggests, or like the articles like, oh, the 30 best climate tech companies according to investors. Like I really just don't like these kind of articles, because I don't think it focuses on any fundamental truths at all. It just focuses a bit on like an echo chamber, if that makes sense. So that is definitely, that is a fear that I have. And we're seeing already a lot of like companies running out of money, not being able to raise the next round, or raising on a down round and not raising as much as they actually probably should to get to the next value inflection point that will then allow them to actually to raise the next round. So it's, I think there's a lot of this like already happening where you have like these perpetuating cycles where if the performance is bad now, then the system is much tighter, right? It's like, it's, we're not in a zero interest rate policy environment anymore.
Yeah.
So it's much more difficult. And that's also why I am like a company where I'm a bird observer for, it's like an optical interconnect company where I'm like so happy to see that. So we just recently closed an oversubscribed round and they have runway until around mid 2026, basically. So that's like amazing, right? That's like, that's really, really good. But if your runway now is like a year, you kind of have to start raising now, because it'll take you definitely more than a year to close around. So all these things, it's and then as a CEO, you're almost spending like 100% of your time just on fundraising. It's like, it's very difficult how you actually then running the company on the back end, right? So yeah, these are sort of some of this time.
Yeah. I think it's just really, I don't know, this is beyond the scope of this podcast, but something that I've only been kind of, let's call it, following investing in general, but mostly focused on climate for, let's say, 4 years about. Mm-hmm. And it seems as though there's been a number of things that I could probably point out where it's like everybody goes into it and then, you know, everybody's realized, oh, wait, we invested in too many companies in this space and now everything's oversaturated. So now we won't look at any single deal in that, even if the newcomers actually are more mature about it or whatever, they're just out. They're not going to be considered, like ESG SaaS is one of those, right? Nobody will look at that anymore. It's not happening, right? Even for people who I think are quite brilliant. So I just find it interesting, this idea that people are constantly just following waves. And there's very few investors who are really not getting caught up in the, you know, the rigmarole and just going with the flow. They're really kind of stable. They have their anchors and they have their ideas. But then that could, again, also be dangerous if you have a particular thesis and you're like, you know what, this is what I'm staking everything on. Maybe that's good as long as it's, I guess, unswayable, and then it'll be proven, right? Then there's no excuses, I guess, if you stick with the thesis there. But on this topic, you've mentioned a couple times early on, right now, something that's really hyped up a lot is AI, right? People mm-hmm. talk about AI quite a lot. If you don't have AI in your business, you're probably not going to get dollars right now. At least that's how it seems sometimes. Can you talk about what your view is on AI and climate? You know, what actually is going to be the impact of AI in helping solve the climate issue, and perhaps any examples of companies you've invested in with the AI component?
I guess generally AI, I find this funny, right? Especially with the semiconductor view. So in a first instance or in the short term, like AI is basically, contributing to emissions, right? It consumes a lot of energy, water, and so on to make all of those. But I'm pretty confident that really like in the long-term view, it's definitely going to have like a really positive impact. We sort of, as inventors, we did only invest in really like mostly like hardware, climate, which is, for instance, like a clean meat or microbiome, which can have basically from skin to gut microbiome health to also food and ag, big impacts there. And it has like this pharma angle, obviously, as well, right? That's sort of why we were really keen on it. But I can take this from the personal viewpoint as well. So I guess I would really divide it into, AI can help with mitigation, or AI can help with adaptation overall, right? So for mitigation, especially as a material science person, I have been quite amazed by seeing a lot of advances in material development, right? This just 2 weeks ago, this was just for the timestamp on this podcast, I guess. So this was November 29th was when this paper in Nature with Google DeepMind came out, right? They have basically, it's called a genome, which is graph neural. Okay, no, I can't. It's like graph neural networks, basically, in mm-hmm. the end. But this project, they have predicted over 2 million new materials and apparently around 400K very stable or mostly stable compounds. And so this, and some of them have been actually tested in real life. I think like around 700 or so of them have been actually made, like synthesized. So just to ensure that this is actually, you know, that your AI is not just telling you that this material should exist and then it doesn't, but you should actually be able to make it, right? Mm. So this was kind of a really cool advancement because it blew up this whole ecosystem. And I think within like 1 or 2 weeks, this paper had like over 100,000 views on the Nature side, which is pretty.
That's a lot, right?
Yeah. I want to be a first, you know, if you're like a first author on this, like this, yeah, you're, yeah.
That's good. That's nice.
You made your thing. So that's sort of what I think is pretty exciting. But the history of this whole stuff goes back to like a DOE project at the time in the early 2010s, like the materials project, sort of like a UC Berkeley and Lawrence Berkeley National Labs joint effort at the time. So this space has been, it existed for a while, but it has really dramatically accelerated recently. So that is what I'm what I think is pretty interesting, there are a few examples, like MitraChem, for instance. They're sort of a battery. Basically, how do I describe this? It would be like a company that uses AI to shorten the development cycle of for certain type of battery materials. Yeah. Mm. So it's like software plus hardware. They actually make materials in the end also. So that, and I think the company is going really, really well. So that is a dramatic success. Maybe one.
Just generally speaking, for the audience, then the major component you're sharing here is that AI can be utilized to, instead of like going in the lab, having an idea and coming up with things on the human aspect, many, many options can be tried on the computer. And then there's like, okay, assigns probability. This one's more likely than not. Here's what you need to do. And then the scientists can go test it. And in some cases, perhaps there's even machinery doing this on its own.
That is basically the gist of it. And some people are also researching like automated labs, which also Merck has like their own efforts of doing this as well. And I think just recently had like this collaboration with the University of Toronto on sort of materials discovery or more accelerated materials discovery in general. So there's also companies who are really piling in to this. And it makes sense. If you're a materials company, there's a lot of benefit you can have from AI if it then really like works, right? That's sort of the crux. And in the past, it hasn't really worked all that well, but I think, that's kind of the truth. But we could be kind of at this transition point where like maybe like finally like with, I mean, yeah, the last year was like insane in AI. So with all of this development, perhaps really this starts mapping much better for materials as well.
Okay, interesting. And then you said that there was also on the adaptation side, there was a couple applications.
Yeah. I guess for adaptation, I would see something like more in the climate resilience bucket could be of tremendous value, where you're more like predicting supply chain, generating insight, sort of recommendation, even when it comes to weather forecasting, right? Like weather forecasting, like accurately for natural disasters, being able to evacuate certain areas earlier, and just not having like false positives where then people say like, it's not going to happen, I'm going to stay at home, and then actually it hits, which I think that's kind of a big problem, right? So that I think is sort of a great, or a relevant example. Doesn't make sense. I don't know, if I would jump back to mitigation, like something related to grid is probably also what I would mention. So around predicting demand and basically how do you in the smartest way integrate renewables, how much, at which time, at which sort of node, how much can that node actually take in terms of power and so on. So I think there's a lot that you can do there for resiliency of the grid and integrating renewables.
Yeah, I definitely think, I mean, being somebody who doesn't quite fully understand, you know, I mean, I don't have any idea if I were to go start an AI company, how you go, like, I have an idea of the principles, but it's always very difficult for me to understand how, you know, where are the best places to take bets when it comes to AI and climate. I think that from what I've noticed, there's a lot of these investments where they have a very positive climate impact as maybe even their core and initial principle or initial area of target. But in many cases, they're also going to become big companies because they'll be able to do other things beyond just impact in climate things. It could be that same technology can be applied to various markets. So it's something that I think is interesting. And I'm going to probably bring that up as I think about it more with other investors in the future. But
But I think overall, if I may just sort of interject that, I think overall, right, climate is at the core of it has to have this hardware driven nature, right? Because I mean, AI itself is just not gonna solve the climate crisis, right? That's pretty.
Yeah, I mean, if you're just building AI and you need all these data centers, then you're not helping at all. But No, I think that's interesting. Yes, it obviously hardware is at the core of it. I think it's. I can imagine being a, you know, assume I'm a, you know, highly talented kind of potential founder thinking about what to build. It's very like challenging to build hardware, right? Sometimes it probably people end up building a hardware company by accident. They're probably lower. I mean, you know, we have the roadmaps on how to fund them now and everything is a little bit more structured, but it's got to be difficult as a founder to decide, hey, I'm going to go work on the hardware thing, even though like it's way different, right? There's no roadmap per se, but we can't just have people navigating and showing us the way with the softwares that are built. We also need people to build the hardware, right?
So, yeah, exactly.
A couple of things I'm just kind of curious. You don't need to name any names, but are there any common mistakes that with either within your portfolio company or elsewhere that you've seen? We talked a little bit about it with the founders, but big mistakes that have been made, whether it was the go-to-market strategy going before there was product market fit, any just common mistakes that you've seen and you would recommend to other companies, hey, just avoid this pitfall.
I'll just quickly sort of repeat some of the things from previously in case someone like jumped to this point. But yeah, I think overall, not underestimating how hard it is to fundraise right now. That can put you sort of out of options in the end. And then you're accepting money that you kind of maybe wish you wouldn't have accepted a year later, or at terms that are very onerous. Terms could be both money as well as in like more like in your documents, right? Like any sort of any information rights or any veto rights for investors that can kind of kill the company in the end. And also really transitioning from R&D to product and business development. I think that's because in the end, as you develop your technology, you need to, at some point, right, you need to be parallel. If only the technology just gets better, but there's no product, then the value kind of still remains at zero, in my opinion, right? I view this a bit as like a multiplication. You have like the technology and then sort of the other factor to multiply by is almost like, right, how ready is it? How did you design for manufacturability? Like this would be like a big topic in hard tech, but especially also semiconductor, like, if you're not designing for manufacturability and you give your designs to a fab, they just like, it's going to be sort of, yeah, they don't know what to do with it because like you need to design things with them in mind, right? Like what can they do? What works well for them? What's an established process, a technique or so. So keeping those things in mind, like really, I think this is a term, designed for manufacturing.
That's interesting. So are there any core principles to that process where, you know, you can kind of share a framework or something where if you are at the point where you've, you know, you've gone beyond the science lab, you're ready to go to build something, right? What are the core principles to follow if you're going for that? Is there like a checklist of some sort or resource you can share?
No, I don't, there's no checklist. I think it really depends on which industry you're really in. Sort of like one thing in semiconductor is like maybe sort of one example, for instance, like if you this is not like looking for, but just sort of very general. If you need a USB port, there is usually like there's basically that module exists in, you can just basically import it into your design. So there's like certain pieces and certain components that you basically need to take sort of the design, the geometry oftentimes also, because you cannot make any arbitrary geometry, basically that you basically need to adhere to those design rules or import sort of the, mm-hmm. the component.
Yeah. I assume you want to work with as much of the existing maybe commoditized type of infrastructure there is and use what you can and then innovate as little as possible to keep costs down initially. Right. So, you know,
risk low, right. Cause like, yeah, if you're trying to establish a new process, then, then your manufacturing partner is probably going to be like, I don't think that's good. No, you should maybe look for another one to do
yeah.
Because then they're going to make a loss or so.
Yeah, you know, reading through, I've already mentioned this on the podcast before, so for some people it's repetitive, but I was reading through the Elon Musk book by Walter Isaacson, and there's like the parts about the manufacturing process, you know, doing it themselves, it's just crazy, right? So if you think about how hard it is to do that, the manufacturers know this, right? They're like, they, as a contract manufacturer, have things that they're trying to keep you in these parameters, right? So try to be aware of that. That's something interesting I'm going to add to my framework. In terms of,
that is
yeah. In terms of, you know, ideas, let's just say tomorrow you were forced to go start a company in climate and you couldn't be an investor anymore. You know, what are some of the ideas that you have, or at least the macro areas where you feel there really needs to be something to solve X problem?
It's obviously, that's pretty hard. I think I would really try to be right now in sort of the areas that I feel like I know best, which is in like the area like sustainability in semiconductor and like a materials angle. So this could be something in more like sustainable processing, or it could be something related to sourcing of the different materials you need, or something completely else. I don't have a super specific thing there, but I feel like I'm seeing like so many things every day that I don't have time to think about what I would do.
Interesting. Yeah. So just to recap, you're saying that you would probably focus somewhere on the supply chain of manufacturing the electronics to make it more sustainable.
Yeah, that would be something that I could see, like whether that's more on anything in the actually sourcing materials, or the sort of the closing the loop in the back end sort of recycling wise, or if it's more about a new process, new process is like hard. I would probably not go into semiconductor, but elsewhere, just because, yeah, if you want to change a process, you probably shouldn't be a startup.
No, I mean, it's a super interesting point. Something I don't think unless you go and scour around, it's not something like product market fit where you know you have to find it. You don't necessarily think, oh, I can't change the manufacturing process. You have to work within the bounds of what's there. Otherwise, getting to the scale is going to be difficult. Any particular advice? I'd be curious, especially just to correct me one thing. Where you invest, is that mostly later stage, like Series B and beyond, or is it also early?
Mostly seed and Series A.
Okay, so that's just a little different than most corporate ventures, so that's interesting. So I guess, you know, when you invest at that point, you see the companies go through a pretty important part of their growth. What is the most important piece of advice you have to founders during that process when it comes to their team building? You talked about hiring, but any particular thoughts around team building and kind of getting those initial people that are really going to be core to your growth?
There's a few things. They should be high caliber, obviously, but something that recently we had like a big discussion about is just about how kind of everybody needs to be hungry. Right, hungry for the mission, the vision, the whole purpose around it, sort of having this real doer mentality, and especially in the early stages, being pretty cross-functional and wearing a bunch of different hats. Right, like in the beginning, everybody should be able to cross over into a bunch of different functions. But I would say overall, thinking about like what are the skill sets that you actually need on board, and just being sort of complementary to each other. The worst thing you can do is probably to have two technical founders. One is like the CEO, the other one is the CTO, and then you hire like a research scientist on top of that, right? Sort of like, but it can obviously, like in a pre-seed, it can kind of start like it. It was a very unlikely thing of us to do. We made a pre-seed investment some time ago, and just because it fit really well within our thesis, and that thought like, okay, we're going to do this anyways, why not now, right? And there we actually said like, hey, we're going to underwrite this risk for you, but we also want you, but we're also going to help you to find a partner in crime, basically like a CEO. So, and then they were like this duo after like a couple months after the round closed, the new CEO onboarded. And then we basically had someone who already had a startup before, but whose background is very technical. So who had kind of like experience from like these two different worlds already with the then new CTO. So, and I think that was sort of a really good combination to really rapidly accelerate.
Yeah, I think that's quite interesting. It's very difficult depending on the founder. You know, it always depends on the personality, if they're interested in sharing the stage, right? And I know some people, I think from, I've heard many people say that the best founders that they've encountered are the people who are thinking, hey, I don't want to be the CEO. I'd rather be the CTO, right? I want to innovate because this is what I do. And I think that is interesting. It takes a level of humility and maturity to do it, but it also takes a level of humility and maturity to be the CEO that didn't found the company, right? And to be respectful of the founders and the mission and the vision, but then lead it in a business oriented way.
That's so true. And that's really like the sort of, you need to, if you're agile enough and you're kind of, I mean, I don't know, people sometimes say the word coachable, right? But just in general, I think that you expressed as well, like the humbleness and just being like knowing what you don't know and knowing what to do to sort of just plug those gaps a little bit to be a more holistic like team with all those different facets that you want.
Yeah,
I think that's really key.
All right. So we're kind of coming to the end here, I'd say. Why don't you give us a bit of advice for, I mean, you're relatively kind of newer to VC as it is, and you have a bit of a closer perspective on the process of getting in. So perhaps your advice to, you know, people who are younger, who are looking to get into VC, whether, I would like specifically, if you can answer both ways, but I'd also like to hear specifically speaking to the more technical crowd, right, on whether or not to get into VC, if they have hesitations, whatever it is. But I'd like to hear your perspective on that specifically.
So if I had something as a technical person in my PhD that I thought would be like really viable to do and to jump into this after graduation, I would, if this would be you, I would totally recommend doing that, right? I would totally pursue this path, because honestly, like after your PhD, this is it's now so normalized to be a CEO of an early stage company with that PhD background, and it's also very really low risk. I mean, there might be some other components, like sometimes. Sometimes there's some personal or some other reasons that might not make it sort of as viable. But in general, if you have the opportunity, I would like totally jump on it. And it's also, even like corporates really like value this later on. Somebody who had this experience early on and who made this jump. If you want to go other routes, like for me, I think VC was just something I found while I was exploring this entrepreneurial path. And what helped me the most is really just to not hold yourself back by thinking you can't do something, but just talking to, just really like go out there and talk to a bunch of people. There's probably, even if you don't pursue this path, you'll learn so much about perhaps things you may want to do in the future or set your eye on towards, or you find out that, you know, this is like complete nonsense and this is not a personal fit for it. But talking to people and like going to, there's so many, depending on where you are, right, obviously, but in some of those hubs, there's just like so many events going on where you can meet like awesome people, cool founders, interesting investors, just general people who are excited about the ecosystem. And that's honestly like a thing that has always fascinated me about climate, because climate is very open. It's kind of very welcoming. There's not many barriers, I think. So people are very eager to take you sort of on sort of take you into on like this journey basically, and there's like Slacks and WhatsApp groups and anything. Yeah, personally, I've also benefited from this. Was the first cohort of the, it was a pandemic hype, kind of like the OnDeck Climate Tech, which doesn't exist anymore, but OnDeck still exists. But it's basically an online community where you like cohorts and it's organized as a program. But there's a lot of touching points, and they really force these touching points, which was great. And they were really, I mean, they're really amazing people in the first cohort, and just, and people I'm still in touch with. So maybe sometimes such a program can just like be this initial catalyst that you might need to really accelerate into a role.
Yeah, I think it's really, really interesting. And this idea that you need to, we talked about it earlier, right? You need to break your frame. You need to put yourself into a different situation. But I really like what you said is, you know, if you have an idea, to go for it, because it's probably easier now than it ever will be, right? A lot of people say it's never a good time to start a company, so you just might as well do it. but it's also, like you said, good experience. I think it's quite kind of fascinating to consider the dilemmas, because, you know, if you look at the data, the stats show that the majority of really, really successful founders, like mega billion founders, are oftentimes founding a company sometime in their 40s or 50s. Like they're older, they've done it before. So it's like kind of counterintuitive if you just listen to that. If you're maybe a data oriented person, you say, well, what are my chances? But I almost guarantee you that if you go into their past, they probably tried something earlier on. Maybe it's not well known, but they probably tried and failed at something. And then those failures taught them a lot when they went to go work in corporate for a while or to go as an investor, and then just this journey. And this is something, as you know, a pretty young person myself, I always think about just trying to understand, like, am I doing the right thing to maximize the future benefit and kind of value that I can bring? So I think it's something difficult to deal with, because when you're young, you just don't have the experience. You don't have you don't know what it's like to go through that experience of working for 10 years, right? I remember when I came up my 3 years with Next Wave, I was like, wow, this is crazy. I've never worked at a company this long, right? And it's just kind of weird. Like you start to see compounding and all these other benefits. So very good.
Yeah, but there's a lot of other things. I feel like if you're an immigrant, if you went to like you studied in another country, right? Like I think very early on, even if you had like some adversity or you put yourself into just kind of stressful situations that you felt like, oh, I really want to go to study in the US, or right, I really want to do XYZ, and then you do it, you succeed. I think those can early on just have dramatic impact already on you. And then what follows after, whether you're like in product at a company or maybe like at an R&D role or in consulting or whatever, really, right? That can also have an impact. But I think even like those very early experience, I think can also really impact your path and just your risk appetite, basically, right? That's what it, I think, comes down to often, like how willing are you sort of to jump into this sort of blank canvas. Yeah.
No, that makes a lot of sense. I really appreciate this. I think we've covered quite a good amount today. Any final thoughts for the audience, Tobias? And where people can reach you at anything? Any asks?
People can reach me. Well, LinkedIn is a good way. That I'm pretty easy to find because my last name is pretty uncommon. So Tobias, Tobias, and last name Egle, Egle. Actually can also firstname.lastname@m-renters.com. That works equally well. And this was super exciting. I think one thing I wanted to say is that, and that kind of, this sort of just this occurred to me, this, I love sort of doing this podcast now, just because what got me into climate, or how I learned about climate, was via podcast as well, sort of in the very beginning. So this is kind of it's almost like a giving back, coming full circle moment. So this is just kind of,
there's always glad to hear it. I think podcasts played a really important part of my life too. You know, it's in a different way, but A lot of people have podcasts nowadays, so sometimes it's hard to keep going, but I do appreciate hearing the good story. So appreciate you coming on. It's been a pleasure, and I'm very, very keen to see how things develop and how your investments go and how things continue to grow in the space. So thanks so much for coming on.
Awesome. Thanks so much for having me.